Young, it's here and now, and it's almost over. Tomorrow, voters go to the polls for the midterm elections. The most recent surveys indicate a bit of a drop in the Democratic advantage in some congressional races, but many contests are extremely tight, and voter turnout is predicted to be its highest for a midterm election in a quarter century. Well, joining us to talk eve of Election Day politics is Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Welcome, Gail.
Good to be here.
And some of the weekend polls, as we say, show a bit of a dip in the huge Democratic advantage we've been hearing about. I'm wondering if you're hearing that the Democrats' lead in so many races was so great that it might actually be a problem for them if people think, well, we don't have to go vote because we already won the polls.
Oh, that is a big issue. The Democrats are trying very strenuously not to appear overconfident, or for that matter, confident at all. I mean, the push over the weekend was just, this is a critical election on both sides, and just get out the vote. But I think people are not, there's really quite an edge among Democratic candidates over the weekend.
Well, and we'll be hearing more about the get out the vote machines from both parties, but there was quite a bit of an edge in one campaign that you were covering. We just want to touch on that because there is some news today in a race that's been peculiar on so many levels. And that's the battle between Republican Virginia Senator George Allen and his Democratic rival Jim Webb. You were at an event today where anti-war demonstrators showed up, Cindy Sheehan among them. Where was this and what happened?
This was at the last subway stop on the Metro line, early in the morning, about 7 in the morning. You know, the sun has been rising.
And we should say this is out in Vienna, Virginia.
Vienna, Virginia. Mm-hmm. The place is packed with demonstrators on both sides. Cindy Sheehan is there setting up, you know, a demonstration about the number of civilian casualties in Iraq, but a lot of Webb demonstrators as well, and, of course, Allen demonstrators. Allen is about a half an hour late. By the time he arrives, there is so much shouting going on that he cannot make himself heard over the noise. There are banners, you know, competing banners, and a lot of jostling. At one point, one of the Webb people actually fell into the senator, almost knocked him over, and it was very difficult to literally get his voice out. And what he said, to the extent that you could hear him, was, look, I've tried to make this a race about ideas and issues, and instead I run into this sort of thing. He's being followed very closely on all of his campaign stops at this point.
It sounded pretty ugly. We understand, according to some wire reports, that one angry protester was screaming in Senator Allen's face, macaca, macaca.
Yeah, yeah, get out of Iraq. The troops hate you.
And he, in turn, told the television interviewer who was trying to interview him that his opponent Webb's point of view is that we ought to be surrendering from Iraq, which, of course, is taken by many Democrats who are against the war as being pretty inflammatory language, so pretty ugly.
Well, this was raised also by Senator Dole in the Sunday talk shows, that Democrats want to lose the war in Iraq.
Well, you know, this was on Meet the Press with Tim Russert.
That's right.
To catch that. What a shouting match incurred after she said that.
That's right. No, this is a very sensitive point. Democrats have lost or not made the gains they feel they should have made in the last two elections on precisely this issue, that they're soft on national security, they can't stand up. What you see in this race is a whole slew of Democratic candidates with very strong national security credentials, and I would include in that Senator Allen's Democratic rival, Webb, who was a former naval secretary in the Reagan administration. Admiral Sestak in Pennsylvania, also in a very good position to defeat Kurt Weldon. So Democrats are not letting the national security issue go lightly.
Well, but we're hearing that this bump in the polls that Republicans got over the last few days came in part because of President Bush's barnstorming across the U.S. in Republican strongholds on just this issue. And it was said to give them a little bounce. And I'm wondering, are you feeling that there's a little bounce in the step, in any rate, in some of the Republicans because of the president's words on staying the course? Again, he didn't use those words, but on the war in Iraq. And also the weekend verdict in the Saddam Hussein trial. Are you seeing that having any impact?
I think both of them have an impact. But remember, look where the president is. He's in the 3rd District in Nebraska, one of the most solidly Republican areas on Earth. He's in Kansas. Remember the book, Whatever Happened to Kansas? What this is about and what the bounce is about is getting the base back. The Republicans have won campaigns on having their base with them and then trying to eat into the independents. This race was in such sad shape that they've had to really shore up the base. And there was a comment that a Republican politician made to me also at the Ellen event this morning. He just said, the base is back. I mean, that is the most positive news they've had in 2 months in this campaign, that the base may be back. A little late, but back.
Well, but on the other hand, we're hearing from other analysts that, in fact, one told the Wall Street Journal today that this election could end up being the revenge of the middle.
That's right.
These are a huge number of independents and loosely affiliated members of both parties that could swing the election. How are you seeing them on the campaign trail?
Well, most, for example, in Colorado, a state where I was recently, more than half of the new registrants are independents, and the fight is definitely over these people, but the question is, will they be motivated enough to turn out? And that's why this is a campaign where the polls are just so useless in terms of giving you any kind of confidence in the outcome, because you know, so much of the polling is depending on, you know, we've got cell phones now that they don't have access to voters in the same way that they used to, and we're just not sure about what the intensity is going to be like. Typically, midterms are low turnout elections. I'm hearing this one could be as high as 42%. But the independents really are the wild card.
Well, it may be useless, but I'm going to throw out the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, because they do say 42% of registered voters said they were independent, 28% Democrat, 24% Republican. But then as we're hearing, as we're learning more about the get out the vote, one of the things that the Republicans did in the primary in many cases was lure Democrats to register as independents so that they could vote in certain primaries, and maybe they'll swing back. Gail Chadwick, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Washington. She's been on the campaign trail today. And just in the few seconds we have, Gail, we started speaking about the Allen Webb race in Virginia and got pretty physical at the train station today. Is Senator Allen okay? We hear he got bonked on the head by a placard at one point.
It wasn't the placard. I was actually right behind him when he was hit in the back with the stick on the placard, which he didn't like a bit. No, what was striking to me was he actually did maintain his composure through all of that. I think he learned from the Makaka incident, which could well sink his career, that you are careful what you say to protesters.
Gail Chadwick with the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, don't be surprised if you have some new best phone friends in the next 24 hours.
Hello, this is Laura Bush. I'm calling to remind you that Tuesday is Election Day. You can make a difference in this election.
Automated phone calls are just one tool. You could get a door knocker, as they're called, as well, as both parties rev up the get-out-the-vote machines. Republicans have been credited with a superior get-out-the-vote effort in the last two general elections, but Democrats say they're catching up. Today we're going to look at how two parties in two states are planning to get their supporters to the polls. First, we go to Rhode Island with one of the tight races that could determine control of the U.S. Senate. A new MSNBC poll shows that incumbent Republican Lincoln Chafee is leading Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse 46-45%, so that's essentially a dead heat. Joining us from Rhode Island, Chuck Newton, Executive Director of the Republican State Committee, who's, I'm sure, exhausted. So thank you for taking the time to tell us, what are you doing now in this 72-hour campaign, as Republicans call it?
The rubber hits the road in the last 72 hours. Literally hundreds of people are manning the phones right now to get out the vote.
We understand lawyers are in town. This is something relatively new to this election. Lawyers who've come in just in case they're needed?
We have a team of about 100 lawyers standing by that will be set up in three centers around the state in anticipation of any irregularities that may pop up. We did this during the primary as well. The Rhode Island election system is perhaps by the most rigorous standards a bit lax. In terms of no identification really being required to vote. So we want to keep an eye on what's going on and who's actually having a chance to get a ballot.
Well, we understand that both parties are getting lawyers before the case as opposed to after. The Democrats saying they want lawyers there in case people are turned away. In the primaries, your get-out-the-vote machine was credited with helping Lincoln Chafee stave off challenger Stephen Laffey. Using something called micro-targeting, helping you to find voters in a way that marketers have long found consumers, with a program called the Voter Vault. Tell us how you use the Voter Vault. Let's say you get someone on the line and then you look in the voter vault to find out something about them. How might you, you know, adjust your pitch to something? If you give me a hypothetical.
You know, with the advent of powerful computers and the like, we're actually being able to take a lot of data and crunch it in a lot of different ways, which gives us a better idea of who's really out there and what's really important to them. So, for example, we might find a voter in Voter Vault. And Voter Vault is nothing but basically a computerized database of, of voter registered voters and the like. But we're able then to tag in other bits of research to help define who that voter is. You might find a woman voter, for example, who happens to subscribe to, hypothetically, Environment Today magazine, whatever. We know that she's contributed to, say, the Sierra Club. So automatically, we're able to discern she's probably going to be more more focused on environmental issues and an environmental approach in the material that we might send to her, or perhaps a phone call that we might make to her.
And we also understand on Election Day you have three call centers set up, and they're standing by waiting for information from vote checkers who've been sent to the state's 577 or so precincts in Rhode Island. So what do these vote checkers do?
Basically, the vote checkers check off, do exactly what the title implies. They check off the people who've come in to vote. Typically, you walk into a polling place, the warden calls off your name. That name is checked off the list as having voted. We've got a long list of people that we want to have vote. So at mid-afternoon, we'll have a list picked up. It'll be rushed to one of our call centers, and the people that haven't been there to vote are telephoned. And we do what we can to get them to the polls to so they can cast their vote.
Wow. Chuck Newton, Executive Director of the Republican State Committee in Rhode Island, he sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you have voted. I mean, you literally go, do you go to their door then and get them in if they haven't voted?
There are cases where we will go and pick up a voter if they're having trouble getting to the polls. And someone will drive them over to the polls so they can vote. There are teams that go into nursing homes here. This is under the auspices of the state, though, but in the nursing homes, they like to help elderly voters who can't get to the polls vote right there in their nursing home. So there's a big effort, and it's officially condoned, if you will, to make sure that as many people that want to vote actually have a chance to do so.
Chuck Newton, again, with the Republicans there in Rhode Island. Chuck, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And you thought it was all up to you. Yes, there is a little prodding, and coming up, we'll head to Minnesota to see how Democrats there are targeting voters. Now, nationwide, according to the Washington Post, Democrats have spent about $43 million to get residents to vote, compared to about $30 million spent by Republicans. But a new Washington Post poll shows that Republicans have been more effective in reaching potential voters in the run-up to tomorrow's election. So we'll see how Democrats are trying to catch up and maybe learn from their colleagues across the aisle. Stay with us. Much more coming up here and now. It's here and now, and with less than a day before the midterm elections, political parties are hitting the pavement, speed dialing the phones to get out the vote. We just heard how Republicans are reaching out to voters in Rhode Island. Now we go to Minnesota, where the governor's race could change the balance of power in the state house. Democratic Attorney General Mike Hatch and Republican Governor Tim Pawlenty are locked in a tight race, with independent candidate Peter Hutchinson a distant third. Joining us now is Josh Jamaki, a director of America Votes Minnesota, which is coordinating the Democrats get out the voter effort. And Josh, we just heard the Republicans are, you know, taking attendance. What are you doing in Minnesota today?
We are out knocking on doors in highly progressive neighborhoods in the core cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth. We estimate 250,000 doors we're going to hit over our 96-hour final push.
Well, but that's always been the strength of Democrats, the boots on the ground, but the Republicans have proven that the technology is what's worked in the last few elections, and we understand that you're going to be using the micro-targeting system that Republicans fine-tune there in Minnesota. So give us an example of how you're using it to find, as we've heard you say, the blue needle in the red haystack.
For us to be effective in Minnesota, you got to do both. We got to go talk to our voters that live in the core cities, but also reach out into more of the swing suburban areas or even into some of the red counties in exurban or rural parts of the state.
Well, for instance, we understand that you've used this micro-targeting in the highly Republican Carver County, which in the past you might have just passed by, but what did you find there?
You know, we found there's two ways of doing it. We've been doing ID work there, so we have been talking to voters, IDing them on where they stand on the potential race, and we found several thousand people that way. Then also combining that with the micro-targeting, found another couple, several thousand people that we never would have found in the past. If we find somebody who cares about education, we'll have a fellow teacher talk to them and share a message about the importance of investing in children and world-class schools.
And the people fall into clusters. Now, Republican micro-targeters have done this in the past. In 2004, they had some clusters like the mellow Bush supporters or the anti-porn, anti-terrorism Republicans, you know, again, clustering them according to this information. What are some of your clusters there in Minnesota?
We did 13. One cluster is the rural religious moralists, and that these tend to be people who, again, live in rural areas, who are observant and go to church regularly, and tend to support candidates who make faith a part of their platform. And we now have a cluster of those voters in Minnesota that we can communicate with, and we may or may not decide to talk to them. We may talk to them about values that we care deeply about, which is, you know, affordable health care for all Minnesotans.
And one last question to you, Josh. We'll send you back to your work. We heard from the Republican director in Rhode Island that they are going to have these poll checkers who are literally taking attendance at the polls and then calling people, you know, as the day goes on if they don't show up. Do you have that as well?
We do it a little bit differently in Minnesota. We have many, many, many more precincts across the state here. We will work in, again, the primarily in the highly progressive neighborhoods where 7 or 8 out of 10 people tend to vote progressive or Democrat. We'll actually go visit every one of their houses here in the last 96 hours and provide them with a sample ballot. We'll provide them a couple of different telephone numbers that they can call. One is if they need a ride to the polls. Another one is if they feel like they're not their voting rights are not being protected. We do have a bank of lawyers set up 12 hours tomorrow who will answer those calls and work with people to make sure that their civil rights are being protected.
Josh Yerjimaki, director of America Votes Minnesota, talking about their Get Out the Vote efforts there. Josh, send you back to your work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, for a little overview now on the Get Out the Vote machines, we want to touch base with Curtis Gans, director of the Nonpartisan Center for the Study of the American Electorate at American University. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
And first of all, let's remind ourselves, this is a relatively new phenomenon. It was the Democrats a couple decades ago who had the boots on the ground, who had the unions and the precinct runners, didn't they?
It was the Democrats about three decades ago that had a centralized voter file. They had precinct captains. You know, they've always had the unions. The difference is that, you know, in the last two decades, they farmed out all their voter registration and voter ID and voter get out the vote to unions, environmental groups, women's groups, African American groups, Latino groups. They have not done it in the centralized fashion that the Republicans have come to do it.
And the Republicans, this is something that we understand was given birth to by Karl Rove, who noticed in the last couple of presidential elections, well, in one case, the President Bush won but didn't win the popular vote. And he made a pact to, you know, centralize this get out the vote. How, you know, how good is it, the Republican get out the vote?
I think the Republican get out the vote has the advantage of going after, you know, voter IDs, having a centralized command, you know, and being able to target resources where they're most needed. The Democrats often rely on groups, some of which are nonpartisan and tax-exempt, who can only go after certain demographic subgroups, you know, African-Americans and what have you. They are less sure of their identification than the Republicans. On the other hand, in this election, it is possible that the Democrats have more fertile territory to organize get out the vote than the Republicans do.
Because?
Up until now, all the intensity has been on the Democratic side. You can have the best operation, but if people don't want to show up, they won't show up. And at this point, at least it, you know, as of yesterday rather than as of today, the Democrats had both more numbers and more intense feelings. That may be changing as we go to tomorrow, but that was an advantage the Democrats had.
Right. Curtis Ganz, director of the Nonpartisan Center for the Study of the American Electorate at American University. One last question. We're hearing about these vote checkers, people actually sort of taking attendance at the polls, and when you don't show up, they try to get you there. How unusual is that?
That has been standard practice for as long as I've been alive, and I'm 69.
So beware, they're taking attendance.
Right.
Curtis, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And tomorrow, don't forget, well, how could you forget? It's Election Day. If anyone has forgotten, call me. It's Election Day tomorrow. We will, of course, cover all the elections across the country in what is really an important election. Some say the first in, 24 years that could tilt the balance in Congress. So we'll take a look at that. Coming up still today, calls for Donald Rumsfeld to resign from the military. More ahead here and now. Funding for Here Young, it's Here and Now. The newspaper of the U.S. military calls for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign, and some prominent neoconservatives who once backed the invasion of Iraq now say they regret doing so. And they're not happy with Donald Rumsfeld either. More on that in a moment. But first, the streets of Baghdad have been mostly peaceful today. It's a different story outside the Iraqi capital. Iraqis north of Baghdad chanted slogans in support of former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. He, of course, was sentenced to hang yesterday in his first war crimes trial for revenge killings of 1982. Anti-Saddam rallies were also held today. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Scott Peterson, Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Scott, first of all, we saw these huge demonstrations over the weekend. Shiites who felt persecuted by Hussein felt vindicated by the sentence, but Sunnis, of course, many of them Baathists, protesting in his defense. What's the mood today?
Well, the mood is very much the same, even though we're not seeing so many demonstrations on the streets. I mean, those demonstrations primarily erupted right after it was seen on television, the sentence being handed down to Saddam, and Saddam's very defiant finger-pointing response. And, of course, the reaction has very much followed the geography of the ethnic and sectarian makeup of Iraq. As you point out, it's the Shiites and the Kurds who are most pleased at this result, and the Sunnis who are most upset about it.
Well, and you have spoken with political science professors, one in particular, who think the verdict was just, but there seems to be concern that it's perceived that the Americans rendered it, and that's going to cause a huge problem in the region.
Well, this has been a problem that's been faced by the Iraqi High Tribunal since its inception in late 2003. I mean, there's been no question that it was basically this court has been created and shaped and framed by Americans and by American experts. And so even though there are Iraqis who have been trained to handle the procedures and conduct the law element of it, if you will, and the sentencing and, conducting the actual trial, the perception certainly in the region and among many Iraqis is that this really is an American-created court. Now, I don't think anyone, certainly in Iraq and probably elsewhere in the Middle East, ever thought that there would have been a different result. But the question is how people are responding to, for example, the fact that this conviction has come after a trial that's lasted for nearly a year, 10 months of testimony, in which really this was a question of revenge killings for just 148 people, which, of course, in magnitude is only a fraction of the size and the scale of the kind of carnage that was meted out during the Anfal campaign, in which an estimated 180,000 people were killed, and also during an uprising, the crushing of the Shiite uprising in 1991, in which tens of thousands of Shiites were killed. So some people feel here that more trials should be allowed to continue so that they can get a fuller sense of justice, if you will, from this type of sentence.
Well, and what does happen with those trials? One that you mentioned is currently underway. He faces a dozen or so, and we understand that there's an appeals process. So what happens?
Well, that's right. I mean, there's an automatic appeals process, and it basically does not spell out a deadline. It needs to meet within 30 days, but it can issue its judgment any time that it wants. There's no set time period in which it must make a decision. Once it does make a decision, and if it does affirm the guilty verdict for Saddam Hussein and the two co-defendants who have been sentenced to death, then they are legally meant to be executed within 30 days by hanging. And that is what the law stipulates. Of course, one other step, too, is that the president of Iraq needs to sign off on that. And at the moment, he has said that he personally is against capital punishment. But beyond that, he said that he has any problem delegating that responsibility to a vice president who would certainly sign off on an execution.
Okay, we'll continue to follow this. Scott Peterson, Baghdad correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Well, now we want to touch on other news regarding the war in Iraq. Today, an editorial printed in today's Military Times says that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld must go. The editorial points out that active duty military leaders have now joined retired officers in criticizing Rumsfeld, and he has lost credibility among the uniform leadership. And separately, some prominent neoconservatives who once called for the invasion of Iraq now say they regret that. And in a still-to-be-published article in Vanity Fair, they also criticized Donald Rumsfeld. Well, joining us from the Pentagon is UPI reporter Pam Hess. And Pam, first of all, the Military Times, it's independent, not connected to the Pentagon, but widely read by the military. But we understand, for instance, there's some criticism of it. The White House, for instance, says it's just a subsidiary of Gannett Newspapers, doesn't represent the military. But still, how much does this editorial in the Military Times, how much is it reverberating there?
It's sort of a hard question at this point because it's so new. I heard that this was coming over the weekend. So there was definitely buzzing going on in the email world with all the folks that sort of track this stuff. The Times family of newspapers are owned by Gannett, which owns USA Today, but they have sort of a cozy relationship with the military in that if they have a message that they want to get out, they always go to them first if it's something very military-specific like pay raises or they want to explain policy. So this is widely read, I think mostly by officers and by their families because there's a lot of quality of life information in it. I think one thing that undermines maybe some of the force of this editorial is that it doesn't have a byline. It's from their editorial page, but if you're going to take a stand against the sitting defense secretary, what I'm hearing from people in uniform is that they'd like to see the name signed to it, who they were, rather than sort of hiding behind so-called anonymity, which an editorial page isn't really anonymous. You can assume that that's the editorial side of things. I don't think it's going to make a difference to Rumsfeld.
Well, what about these Vanity Fair reports? I just want to make sure we've touched on that.
Yeah.
An article to be published in January's Vanity Fair, but leaked, in which neoconservatives such as Richard Perle and Kenneth Edelman, both Pentagon advisors, in fact, both considered architects of the war in Iraq, saying things like, if we'd been Delphic, I mean, Richard Perle saying, if I'd been Delphic and someone had said, should we go, I think I probably would have said no, regretting the invasion, criticizing Rumsfeld. I mean, this, considering how involved they were in the invasion of Iraq, this is pretty astonishing.
It's actually not that astonishing for this reason. They've been saying it for at least a year. Elliot Cohen had a piece July 10th, I think, 2005, in the Washington Post, where essentially he arrived at the same conclusion. His son was going off to war, and this gave him an occasion to think about it. And he said, you know what, the war is right. It's just been pursued poorly. So they've been sort of distancing themselves from this since day one. These are ideologues, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. They're people who are driven by an ideal, which is the use of military power to do moral good in the world that they consider to be a free enterprise system and liberty. And they, rather than disavowing that ideal, they are attacking the people who executed the war. And it's not just Rumsfeld. It's also Bush. It's Cheney. And it's the uniform military.
Well, and I want to rush to say the comments weren't leaked. Vanity Fair released
right.
The quotes. And the neocons who were quoted are now angry because they say it was supposed to be published after the elections.
Right.
And so we'll see if this has any impact. But now saying, whoops, perhaps the war in Iraq was not only not a good idea, but wasn't executed well. Pam Hess, Pentagon correspondent for United Press International. We'll continue to follow this story as well. Pam, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ron.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, and on a lighter note, what do politicians and public radio have in common? Raising money, of course, and it seems as if some politicians are learning a trick or two from public radio by picking up on that tried and true phenomenon, the pledge drive.
Good afternoon. I'm Joni Davis, campaign manager of the Tom Johnson for Congress campaign. And with me is campaign treasurer Jim Jackson.
Hi, Joni. Hello,
Hi.
Everybody. Now, we'll return you in just a few moments to our regular schedule of C-SPAN, self-government, and political scandal. But as many of you know, every couple years we take just a little bit of time out of the legislative process to remind you just how important Congressman Tom Johnson is to your life.
And the truth is, Tom Johnson's congressional career is only made possible by people just like you, people who truly understand the value of Tom Johnson.
Indeed. Now, we know you listen to Tom Johnson. Chances are he's an essential part of your daily routine. You probably listen to him in your car when you're working around the house, right?
And if you're like me, Jim, you wake up with Congressman Johnson almost every day.
But we also know that only one in six, Joni, of you hearing us right now has actually contributed and become a member of the Johnson campaign.
That's why we need you to call in or contribute online. We've got a goal of 45 campaign contributions by the end of the hour. You hear those phones?
You think we
can do it, Jim?
Of course we can, but you have to call with your support. Now, this is very exciting. For the next 15 minutes, every contribution will be matched 100% by the National Retailers Association Political Action Committee.
Oh, wow.
Those retailers, Joni, are eager to give money to Congressman Johnson, but they can't do it alone. Looks like we've got maybe 10 people on the line. I know we can do better than that.
Think about what Congressman Tom Johnson means to you. Isn't a hardworking, scandal-free congressman worth at least a dollar a day?
Well, heck, I spend more than that on a cup of coffee, I think.
he does.
Love the coffee. Now, Joni, what are some of the special thank you gifts we have for people who make campaign contributions?
Oh, well, Jim, at the $100 contribution level, we have our limited edition Congressman Johnson tote bag. Isn't that nice, Jim?
That's a collector's item.
Yes, and it's blue. Isn't that nice?
Yes.
Yes,
he's a
blue.
Republican, but we made it blue. I don't know what we were thinking.
For $200, you'll get the new 2-CD set, Family, Faith, and Fiscal Responsibility, Congressman Tom Johnson's greatest hits.
Mm.
All of the unforgettable bits are on there, including the speech at the Kiwanis Club and the interview
with Wolf Blitzer. Is
that's
it there?
Right. It is.
That's my
it's
favorite.
There.
Oh, man.
Yeah,
I was hoping that was on there. Now, we're asking you to give whatever's comfortable for you. Any citizen, any amount. But suppose you're able to give, say, the maximum amount allowable by law, $2,100, right? You'll become a member of what we call our Circle of Leadership.
Wow.
Now, at that level, you'll get a tour of Congressman Johnson's office, and we'll submit a bill of your choice on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives.
We need to keep those phones ringing. Think about where we'd be without Tom Johnson, without high-quality legislation like House Resolution 452, making November National Soybean Grower Recognition Month.
Yes. Who else brings you Amendment 1354B, securing funds for runway repairs at Jacobstown Municipal Airfield?
No.
None of this would be possible without your support.
We want to get back to running the country. Really, we do. But we're still about 25 contributions short of this hour's goal. Let's keep those contributions coming, and remember,
any citizen, any amount.
1-800, not, oh, I'm sorry, I couldn't stop myself. Our parody on politicians and the pledge drive was recorded in front of a live audience for the program In the Loop from Minnesota Public Radio.
Yetchimash, and my name is Borat. I like you. Is this my house? Answer, please.
Well, a lot of people entered Borat's house this weekend. The Sacha Baron Cohen mock documentary, Borat Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan, topped the box office even though it opened in only 800 theaters. Cohen appeared in character as the boorish Kazakhstan TV reporter Borat on the Today Show today to ask host Matt Lauer for some celebration tips.
Matt, can you recommend any good prostitute? Yes? He tell me you are the one to ask.
That's Sacha Baron Cohen as Borat on the Today Show. Matt Lauer, never invite Borat. Never, never invite Borat on. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now.
Thank you so much. That was so interesting.
Wow, what a good idea for an event.
Recently, Joyce Maynard joined several other authors at a book signing at the Pine Hills, a planned community in Plymouth, Massachusetts. In each book, Joyce draws an elaborate cartoon of a woman wielding a hatchet. That woman is Nancy Seaman, a former fourth grade teacher in the gated Detroit community of Farmington Hills, who was convicted in 2004 of killing her husband Bob, a former auto engineer. The book's title, Internal Combustion, the story of a marriage and murder in the Motor City.
What are the numbers referred to in the box?
That's her, like, number? Her prisoner number. Actually, if you go online, you can see her mugshot.
Oh, gosh. Oh, okay.
Nancy Seaman claims she killed her husband in self-defense as he attacked her. But using store videos, prosecutors proved that she drove to Home Depot and coolly bought the murder weapon, a hatchet.
What do you write?
S-O-O-H-D. Stay out of Home Depot.
Internal Combustion is the story of the Seaman family's implosion, pitting sons Jeff and Greg against each other as they sided with different parents. It's also the story of the Detroit car culture. Bob had an extensive Ford Mustang car collection, including the Shelby model, and a boss. Jeff rebuilt a Mustang with his beloved father, but Nancy bought a Mustang for Greg, maybe to keep him from having that bonding experience. Well, here, fans line up as much for the story of the cars as for the murder.
My first car was a 1965 Buick Wildcat with a 445 engine. My father and I, we worked on it. So I, as she was describing the Mustang and the experience with parents and children and cars, I thought she described that industry and that experience well.
Joyce Maynard, also author of To Die For and At Home in the World, her memoir about her relationship as a teenager with the much older J.D. Salinger, would discover through the story of the Seaman family something about herself. But she didn't know that at first.
I'd been on the lookout for a good murder, Robin. I was, like so many people, a big admirer of In Cold Blood and of the challenge of telling a true life murder as grippingly as a novel. But I wanted it to be a murder about something that I cared about, and family and relationships were top of the list.
How did that change as your reporting went along?
Well, I guess I came into the case with a certain sympathy for the woman that's kind of automatic. The crime was so terrible that there's a certain reasoning that goes on in your head, well, there must have been something terrible done to her to precipitate this. But as the months unfolded and I began to piece together the story of this family, a much more complicated reality than the classic story of abusive husband, victim wife began to take shape, and it was a deeply disturbing one. And the idea of attempting to befriend this woman to get her to talk with me became deeply unsettling.
As Truman Capote befriended the killers in his book In Cold Blood.
And I have to add that I have nothing but admiration for that book. At the same time, I knew that I couldn't have done what he did to get my story. She was, in my view, an extraordinarily manipulative and cynical exploiter of the battered woman defense for the purpose of attempting to get away with first-degree murder. I've asked myself why I'm so fascinated with crime, and part of it, I believe now, is the way unthinkable acts by other seemingly normal human beings reveal to us aspects of ourselves that we might not want to look at, or require us to ask, could I ever commit a murder?
And your answer?
No. As angry and at times bitter as I have known myself to feel as a divorced woman going through, you know, the kinds of things that everybody who's gone through a divorce understands very well, taking a hatchet to my ex-husband's skull never entered my brain. But what I did see was the kind of emotional violence that took place in that family. There were more victims of Nancy Seaman's rage than her husband. And that was the part that unsettled my sleep.
Referring to her sons, divided against each other, each taking the side of a parent.
Yes, exactly. And I think even very well-intentioned parents who've been through divorce might recognize some of that impulse to align their children on their side, and have also felt that kind of abandonment when the children we love most in the world go off to the person who has perhaps brought us some of the most pain. And that was the slow lesson of living with this story for a year for me.
And I'm wondering, you have written very powerfully in my mind about your own life. Was there ever a thought on your mind, I'm not going to write about me, this is them? And then suddenly you couldn't not write about you.
Well, I didn't expect to become a character in this book, but I always feel that the story that I tell will not just be the story of what happened, but the story of what happened as I have seen it. And in the same way with At Home in the World, I never pretend that that is the book of record about my time with J.D. Salinger, and were J.D. Salinger to write the book of that year, no doubt, let's not hold our breath for that one, it would be a very different book. All I can tell is my own story. I began by reading about a crime I could not imagine, and by the end, I felt I knew where it came from.
And also, to your surprise, had learned something more about yourself.
Yes.
Well, and the other thing, I mean, those are the deeper reasons, but I'm thinking that you also, you know, a self-described woman who knew nothing about cars, you also learned an awful lot about Mustangs.
About cars. There's no way to look at the story of this family without looking at the culture out of which they came. This was a woman, let's not forget, who when her husband of 32 years told her he was leaving her, said to him back, "You'll never get the Shelby." The Shelby Mustang, which was the prize of his Mustang collection. And of course, Detroit car culture is crumbling around them as the story unfolds.
When you were signing books here tonight, one fellow said he identified with the relationship that one of the Seaman sons had, Jeff Seaman, had with his father because they had built a car together.
Yes.
Yeah. At one point, you do talk to Jeff Seaman, the one who loved his father so much, who didn't believe his father abused his mother. And you asked to see his car. Tell us about this car, and then if you could just read that passage.
This one particular car, the Boss, is another beloved Mustang. Theirs was a 69 Mustang Boss that he had rebuilt with his father. Do you want me to read it?
I would love that. You asked to see the Boss, and I'd love you to read his response to you.
"Can you take me to see the Boss? Could we go for a ride in that car?" His answer was not unkind or angry, but it was firm and came without a moment's hesitation. "You won't ever see the Boss," Jeff told me. The Boss was personal. "I would never trade my Boss for 50 Bosses," he went on. As he spoke now, he had the air of a man delivering a poem, though with utterly no awareness that he was sounding that way, I knew. His voice had changed register, however, and his eyes looked different, too. "You can look at all the Bosses you want on the internet, just not my Boss." "It's a very symbolic thing," he said. "It's the first thing my dad and I worked on together that I contributed to, and to me, that is priceless. I could talk about the Boss for 5 days and never talk about anything automotive. It's on a higher plane. It's not about the car. And I can tell you now, whatever Greg feels about owning the Shelby, he will never understand that. Anyone with half a brain and a key could start the Shelby, but the Boss is different that way. The Boss takes a certain touch. I don't let other people work on this car. My dad touched this car. The only person that's going to work on this car is me. He drives it, though. Sometimes, on weekends, Jeff and his wife, Becca, go for a ride in the Boss. It might be all a person needed to know about his marriage to hear Jeff say that Becca understood his car."
Joyce Maynard, reading from her book, Internal Combustion, The Story of a Real-Life Marriage and Real Murder in the Motor City. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.